Please be seated. This morning I intend to preach a sermon on what I believe to be the second most important attribute of the Christian faith. So apologies in advance, no adventurous stories from childhood, no crazy tales about the folly of parenting, no wild stories about what it means to be a priest in the 21st century. Just some straight up teaching about the Christian faith in light of where we find ourselves today. And I'm going to preach about this second most important attribute of the Christian faith because I believe that it can be, for some of us, if not all of us, a confusing time. Just a moment in time on the historical timeline where it's confusing to identify as a Christian, because there is this enormously wide range of what humanity believes is the objective of the person who seeks to embody the Christian faith. And we have agreement in some areas and disagreement in other areas. And in order to talk about the second most important attribute of the Christian, I need to go backwards a little bit. And I'm going to go back historically so that we have some sense of where we find ourselves today and why it's confusing to be Christian. If you are a student of church history, even on a sort of cursory level, if you were to examine the history of the church from the time that Jesus began to walk around and preach and teach and heal up until today, one of the things that you might recognize, maybe not, but you would likely recognize, is that the church tends to reform itself from time to time. And these reforms come in like 500-year increments. I know, that's a lot of years, right? And it's a lot of years to keep track of in our own minds. But I would take us back this morning to the Protestant Reformation. Now, if you remember, the Protestant Reformation happened about 500 years ago. So we find ourselves today in a moment in an era of reform. Here's what happens in the church, somewhat unscientifically. As we emerge out of a reform, we seem to have like one strong rope. The faith is one strong rope. And over the course of the next 500 years, humanity, those seeking to embody the faith itself, begin to unbraid and examine each strand that makes up the rope. So if we think as we emerge from about 500 years away from the Protestant Reformation up until today, what we have today is like a lot of unbraided strands of rope. And so it's confusing to get sort of a unified understanding of what Christianity is, does, means for the world today. And there's nothing wrong with this process that we do. It's a good process, and it creates good reform as we examine each braid of the rope. But at the 500-year mark, after everything is unbraided, we begin to put things back together again. And that's sort of where we find ourselves today. Now, if you remember, and I'm going to speak in major generalities here, in order for us to just understand what happened 500 years ago, it is the reform that we experienced that I'm referencing was only part of the church. It was the Western part of the church. So, you know, in the 16th century, there was Rome and there was Antioch. I'm not talking about Antioch, the Orthodox side of the church, the Eastern side of the church. But the Protestant Reformation affected the Western side of the church. And it gets embodied in two kind of differing points of view. As the church moves toward this moment of reform, we see the institutional church in the West, known as the Catholic Church, becomes very focused on the institution itself. And we become empire builders toward the institution. And we could, in generalities, explain what happened is that the Catholic Church becomes intensely focused on deeds, on works that are church-based works. So the idea, like if you wanted to be a good Christian in 1500, what do? You go to church on Sunday. You make a confession. You receive the Eucharist. You say your prayers. You give money to the institution so the institution can embolden itself and embody a wider stance across the world. But the work of the faith becomes institutionally focused rather than like gospel focused. So how are you a good Christian? You're a good Christian by paying your indulgence, not by helping your neighbor carry in her groceries from the car, right? And so across Europe, clergy and other faithful Christians and theologians begin to react to this. And they're like, no, like that's not what it's all about. That's not in the story as we read it. It's something different. And what we see is in that Protestant side, the pendulum swings all the way over to the other side. And the other side embodies this argument of this line from one of Paul's epistles in the letter to the Ephesians. It is by grace that we are justified through faith. So Protestant reformers are saying to us clearly of like, no, like you don't have to go to church if you don't want to go to church. That's not what being a Christian is about. Christianity is embodied in the faith itself. And that's how we access the grace of God. So you hear me Sunday after Sunday say like, hey, you don't have to do anything to be loved by God. And it's absolutely true. And this thought comes through the Protestant Reformation. Like everybody gets a seat on the bus. Not everybody gets to drive. But everybody gets a seat on the bus. There's nothing you can do or not do. There's nothing you can say or not say to distance yourself or to separate yourself from the love of God. That's this great inheritance that we've gotten. But here we are in 500 years away from that moment in time, and there's some things that have happened in the history of humanity, especially in the West, that have influenced the way that we embody the faith. And I believe like influenced negatively, honestly, and we find ourselves in a moment in reform. So if you think about what's happening in the 16th century and you fast forward a couple hundred years, we get this thing called the Enlightenment. You remember this from 10th grade Western Civ, right? You're like, oh yeah, I think I kind of remember that idea of like what's, you know, as humanity becomes more thoughtful, more oriented to our brains, something happens to the faith that affects the faith negatively. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean to say, and this is, again, a very simplistic way of describing it, but faith becomes synonymous with belief. So there's no real embodiment of good works, but it's like that natural cascading effect as we move through in the Enlightenment. The faith, the embodiment of the Christian faith, becomes conceptual rather than activated. Now, here's how this affects the Episcopalian today in 2024. We're going to experience it not all of us, but the vast majority of us, more than 90% of us, this very day in church. This reality that we're rubbing up against, faith and belief becoming synonymous, becomes a rub for Episcopalians right after the sermon. Do you remember what happens right after the sermon? We stand up and we say the creed together. And so many of you and so many people in every other church that I've served, Episcopalians come to me at the door and they're like, you know what? I love this church. But when we say the creed, there's certain sentences that I leave out. We get this idea that like the embodiment of a Christian today is like a laundry list of things that we believe rather than something more expansively. And we have inherited this moment in time where a good portion of the church thinks that being a Christian is just about like ascribing to a certain laundry list of things that we all collectively believe. Like, Jesus was the Son of God. John, do you believe Jesus was the Son of God? Sure, yeah, I do. Okay, then we're all Christians. And you're like, yeah. But then we get to this place in life where we're like, wait a minute. Oh, gosh. It's more than that, right? Because you just can't go to church on Sunday and say that you believe in all of that stuff and then go back to the office Monday through Friday and step on people's faces. Like, it's not, like, there's something there that just doesn't feel right, right? And voila, here we are in this moment of reform in the church where we're like, wait a minute, yeah, there is something to this idea about belief and work, the things that we think about and say that we believe, and the things that we do need to match up. And so studious Episcopalians go back through and beginning to scan the scriptures, and we try to find some orienting passage, and we find it in the epistle to James. There are these two beautiful lines, some of my favorites in all of the church, but in the first chapter of James, you hear James write, "Do not merely speak my word," the word of God, the Logos, the Jesus. "Do not merely talk about Jesus and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says." Or later in that letter, we hear James write, "Faith without works is dead. It doesn't mean anything. There's no connection there. There's something missing when we just believe in concepts, but we're not led to embody them in a meaningful way at all." And so in these moments of reform, when all the strands of the rope are unbraided, we Christians go back to the original source in order to recoup and refresh and renew and resurrect the faith itself. And the source there are the Gospels. We go back to Jesus himself in order to try to find some new direction which will help us take each unbraided strand and restrand it back to a strong, unified expression of faith that might last another 350 to 500 years. And when we do that, when we do that as Christian people, when we go back to the Gospels and we really look at the teaching of Jesus and how Jesus articulates a relationship with God and humanity, we see that he does two things. He does a whole lot of healing, and he does a whole lot of teaching. And when we begin to look at the healing, we find that there is a unifying theme in the healing that Jesus does. Primarily, the healing that he does is centered around the expression of loving kindness in the world. There is a leper on Sunday whose hand is frozen. Jesus breaks from tradition and heals him there on the Sabbath. Why does Jesus heal him on the Sabbath? Because he's a rebel with the fist in the air? He wants to like shake up the church? No, he does it because it's lovingly kind. And he questions those pew sitters and those rabbis who have watched this man come into church Saturday after Saturday. And he says, why have you not extended this loving kindness to this man who has been suffering with a withered and paralytic hand? And then we examine the teaching that he engages in. That too, the source of the teaching, the point of all his teaching, is loving kindness, right? So Jesus gets into this argument with a religious lawyer. And the lawyer, as he is deposing Jesus, says like, okay, like what's the most important, what are the most important points of being a faithful person, of being a child of God? And he says it very succinctly. He says, love God and love your neighbor. No exceptions. That's it. That's the rule. Loving kindness. Loving kindness on the healing side, loving kindness on the teaching side. You see, the most important attribute of the Christian, as the Christian seeks to embody the faith, is loving kindness. That's what we mine from these tales, from these stories about the life and teaching of Jesus that we find in the Gospels. The most important attribute of the Christian is loving kindness. But I told you, I intend this morning to preach a sermon about the second most important attribute of the Christian. And so I'm going to do that. I'm going to get to the point right now, I promise. If you go back to this passage that we have from the Gospels today, it's such a rich story. It's short, it's concise, it's one of my favorites of many, many favorites, but it's one of my favorites. We have this tale about Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, this blind man, and we know it's an important story because whenever there are both geographic locations and proper names in the story, that's like our like signal fire smoke or our highlighter to realize like, pay attention, folks, something's going on here. That's the story's way of saying like, okay, in the next few sentences, I'm going to deliver something big. And if we just read through this story, we think like, oh, he delivers something big, a miracle. That's not the miracle. That's not what's being delivered here. What's being delivered here is so much more important for us, especially as we seek to embody the Christian faith in 2024. It's so important. So following the beats of the story, we see Jesus and his disciples moving through a crowd of people. It says that they're in Jericho, this religiously significant place, not the most important place to Israel, but a place of importance. And then you hear this man identified as Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, a blind beggar, and he begins to speak in the story. And he says, Jesus, son of David, now that's important. What Bartimaeus is doing is he's saying, like, you are not doing something brand spanking new here, Jesus, and I see that. By calling him the son of David, Bartimaeus is acknowledging the fact that Jesus is at the very least a prophetic teacher of great importance within a line of teachers in Israel. He is also, by using David and say, not Isaiah or Jeremiah, he is identifying him as the potential Messiah. Like, here comes the warrior king who is going to reorder everything. He says, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. That is the most beautiful moment in the story itself. You see, Bartimaeus, as the crowd is moving around him, and if you think about it, like, Bartimaeus is down on the ground, and this whole group of people, this whole group of very religious people, are not attending to this blind beggar at all. And what Bartimaeus does is he says, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. He says, Jesus, I see who you are. Please help me. I need help. The second most important attribute of the Christian is our ability to ask one another for help. If I took you all the way back to the very beginning of the story, Genesis 1, and we look at the activity of God, how creation itself is activated. Creation itself is activated through the spoken word. God speaks creation into existence. And in this moment in time, when this blind beggar, Bartimaeus, says, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me, Bartimaeus is speaking a new reality between Bartimaeus and Jesus and between the whole crowd that is witnessing what happens. You see, when the Christian has the courage and the vulnerability to say, I need help, something miraculous happens between the person seeking the help and the one who is petitioned to bring the help to bear on that person's life. Something beautiful happens. Opportunity for loving kindness emerges. When we have the courage and the vulnerability to ask for help, a cooperative kingdom comes into being in that very moment. This is what Jesus is talking about in the Gospels when he says, the kingdom has come, or be aware of the kingdom of God. It's all around you, or it's come near to you. When we ask for help, when we have the courage and vulnerability to engage the other in the assistance, in the restoration, in the nurture, in the sustenance of our own lives, a beautiful reality emerges. Now, I must say, because we're all Westerners and because we're all Americans, I know that if not consciously, at least unconsciously, something is going through your mind right now. And I just want to step on it and stomp it out. One of you in this room is thinking right now, but Jimmy, we all know, we all know that God helps those who help themselves, right? No. I am not marking out a line in the Bible, people. That does not exist in the Bible. That wisdom comes from antiquity. It comes from the plays of Sophocles and Euripides. And then it becomes popular for us by whom? Does anyone know? Benjamin Franklin. Not Jesus, but Benjamin Franklin brings us close, right? Yeah, maybe, maybe not. I know how hard it is to ask others to help us when we need help. It's just about as vulnerable as we get. And I also know without it, without the ability to ask another for help, we miss out on the kingdom coming in that very moment. And we deny our brother and sister an opportunity to embody the most important attribute of the Christian person, loving kindness. So, church, you have some homework this week. But I'm going to put some conditions around the homework. It's important. The homework is that this week, and then before you come back to church next week, I want you to ask someone for help. However, you may not, capital N, capital O, capital T, you may not ask someone for help in a fee-for-service relationship. Okay? You are not doing your homework if you pick up the phone and you call your gardener and say, like, isn't it about time to come get these leaves picked up for me, please, 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 and then send me a gigantic bill. That's not what I'm talking about. There is a second condition. This may be more important than the first. This work of asking for help is much, much harder than you think it is right here and right now. But trust me, it is. When you ask someone for help this week, and I know most of you will do your homework, when you ask somebody for help, I want you to ask someone who you already love and trust, so that your vulnerability might be received in a place of sincerity and might be welcomed with soft hands. And I want you to ask that person who you trust and who you love, because I want you to fully experience the power of kingdom coming when humanity, when one human being asks another human being for that kind of help. So you have some homework this week, church. The grade is always A. Everybody gets a seat on the bus. Not everybody gets to drive, but everybody gets a seat on the bus. And this is how we learn to embody the faith in a time of confusion and maybe even frustration or fear. The second most important attribute of the Christian faith is the ability to ask for help. The most important attribute of the Christian faith is the embodiment of loving kindness in the world that surrounds us. Amen.